Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So as is our practice, we begin with a land and ancestor acknowledgement. We honor the original inhabitants of this place, the Dakota and Anishinaabe peoples, whose descendants are still here and whose lands we occupy. We honor the reason why we are here, unfolding the teachings that come to us through our Indian, Chinese, and Japanese spiritual ancestors. And we offer gratitude for all the teachers who have come before us. We acknowledge the systemic oppression that has been perpetrated and is still being perpetrated in the United States of America. In particular, we grieve the treatment of Black people who are still affected by the legacy of slavery. We give this land and ancestor acknowledgement so that we will remember that we are all connected, have compassion for each other, and act on that compassion. So this morning, I'd like to share a little bit of teachings from the Diamond Sutra, which is one of the earliest Mahayana Buddhist sutras. And the Diamond Sutra is basically conversations between the Buddha and Subhuti, one of the Buddha's main disciples. And I had a thought kind of cross my mind just earlier sitting and knowing there's a lot of new people and thinking, okay, Diamond Sutra. So people who know the Diamond Sutra kind of laughing. I'm going to try to make it as accessible as possible. I think it's a beautiful teaching and it can be helpful for everyone. So anyway, in the Diamond Sutra, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm not even going to talk about the whole thing. But that's okay, because I think just even getting a taste of it will be enough to hopefully help us. So in this sutra, Subhuti begins by asking the Buddha how a bodhisattva should behave. Actually, that's kind of the whole thing, is like how a bodhisattva should behave. And the Buddha answers, the Buddha's answers addressed that the how a bodhisattva should behave is based on how they should view the world. So it starts with how they view the world or reality, and then that behavior will come from this enlightened view, the behavior. And I should say bodhisattva means, a being who is basically devoted. It's their life mission is to help or save or free all beings from suffering. So Subhuti is asking, well, how should that happen? How should I do that? How should bodhisattvas do that? And the Buddha, and all the Buddha's answers are about, first you establish this kind of view. And I'll talk more about that. And so what I'm going to speak on today is two sections from the Diamond Sutra. And really my impetus is how these teachings can help us overcome hopelessness. So I don't know about you, but every once in a while, especially when I'm reading the news, hopelessness can arise. So I'll talk about the practice of transcendent wisdom, or Prajnaparamita, which can help us see the profound interconnection of everything in the universe. And I'll talk about the practice of transcendent patience, or Kasanti Paramita, which we can do. We can practice transcendent patience with the help of transcendent wisdom. Actually, all the transcendent practices help each other, but those two, like in particular, I think to have transcendent patience, we need transcendent wisdom. And then finally, I'll talk about how these two practices can help us engage in enlightening action for ourselves and others. So here's an excerpt from the sutra, which kind of gives you a little taste of what the sutra is like. So this is reading directly from a translation of the sutra. The Buddha said, "Sabuti, what do you think? Are all the specks of dust in the billion world system of a universe many?" Sabuti said, "Yes, Buddha, the specks of dust are many." I just want to do an aside here because I just saw a documentary called Everything and Nothing. And it was about, you know, sort of the creation of the universe and also like subatomic, you know, behavior of subatomic particles. And one of the things that was very striking was that the narrator standing on a beach holding up, you know, sand, saying that speck of sand, if that were our sun, like the one star, and then all the sands and all the beaches of all the world, the stars or the suns in the universe are more than that. Okay, so this is a question that the Buddha is saying, Sabuti, what do you think? Are all the specks of dust in the billion world system of a universe many? Sabuti said, yes, Buddha, the specks of dust are many. And how so? Because what the Buddha says is a speck of dust, the Buddha says is no speck. Thus, it is called speck of dust. So no speck doesn't mean like it's not a speck, it's not little. It means it doesn't exist. So how are the specks of dust many? This is the teaching of the Diamond Sutra over and over like this. It's a speck of dust because it is no speck of dust. Thus, and then it comes back to, thus, it is called a speck of dust. And what the Buddha says is a world system, the Buddha says is no system. Thus, it is called a world system. So this may seem paradoxical. It may seem inscrutable. But really what it's pointing to is that a speck of dust, you know, or an atom or whatever we want to say, is entirely dependent. Let's say it's an atom, for example. It's entirely dependent on non-atom elements for its existence. It's not an atom by itself. So even like within that world system of an atom, if you know anything about physics, it's, you know, there's a nucleus with protons and neutrons, there's electrons, there's these things that make up an atom. And that's how it can be an atom, because of these non-atom things. So that's in a kind of a simplistic, mechanical way of looking at it. And so, it's not an atom by itself, so the Buddha says it is not an atom. But because it does coexist with all the non-atom elements, we can call it an atom. So, and that is true with ourselves too. So seeing ourselves as not separate and not not solid in the sense that we're made up of all the things that make us up. And then also, in this section, with a world system or universe. It's dependent on everything else for its existence. And in that way, it's not a universe by itself. So the Buddha says it's not a universe. But since it does exist in dependence with all other things, we can call it a universe. And just another little geek aside. In that same documentary, it talked about how when you create a vacuum where there's nothing, take out everything, all the air, everything, you have a vacuum, what you find is then suddenly, poof, matter, antimatter are created. And then poof, they go back together. So I'm like, oh, this is the Diamond Sutra. So we're like on the side totally of matter. It's matter, and we don't see like we exist because there was antimatter. And one of the things in the documentary says, we're the debris that's left over, you know, like the little particles of matter that didn't link up with the antimatter and go back together. So we're existent completely dependent on non-existence. When we have a view like that, it's a little bit easier not to get attached to our own ideas, you know, of a separate self or what should be. So, the teaching of the Diamond Sutra actually carries the idea, you know, further than just like material things, and it talks about even wisdom itself is empty. It doesn't exist by itself. Wisdom is empty. And you can kind of see that when you look at we have in Buddhism the six paramitas, or sometimes called the six perfections, or I like to say transcendent practices, that's another translation. These are practices that a bodhisattva does, so a being who wants to help and save and free all beings from suffering does these transcendent practices. And they're prajna, or wisdom, dana, or generosity, sila, or ethics, morality, ksanti, or patience, virya, or enthusiasm, or joyous effort, and jhana, or meditation, concentration. So I'm not going to talk about all six today. As I said, I'm going to kind of focus on the wisdom and compassion. But there's a way in which you can see that all of these help each other, and you really can't have one without bringing in the others. So in that way, the wisdom doesn't exist by itself. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen teacher, says about this, "We should practice in an intelligent way, learn to look deeply, so we'll realize that even transcendent understanding, or wisdom, is not an independently existing dharma, and Buddha's teaching has no separate nature." And Meng San, a modern era Chinese teacher, says, "Think about your own name. Then ask yourself, is this me? If it isn't me, who is it? Since this is who I am, I might as well say it's me." He says, this is what is meant by practice. What else can you use to practice? So, whatever we may think about ourselves, we can say, if we look deeply, like, that's not me, that's not the only thing that's me. I'm not defined by that one thing, like a name or whatever it is. So that's the no, it's not there. No, there's no speck of dust. But then we say, yeah, but then I might as well, like, here it is. I am in the world, even the dependent on things, so I might as well just practice like that. I might as well say it's me. But that second one, I might as well say it's me, is kind of free of attachment to me in the same way that at first, maybe before we thought about it, we're just going along, and we usually have a lot of attachment to ourselves. So I think this is really encouragement on how we can practice with our own body and mind, not trying to be someone else. It also could be called, as we say in one of our, when we recite the precepts, one of the preambles is using all the ingredients of our lives. So this is one way to practice wisdom. And then, like I said, there's the practice of transcendent patience. And I promise this is related to how to an antidote for hopelessness. So in the Diamond Sutra, the teachings on patience are related to selflessness. So our friend Subhuti from the Sutra was known for his deep understanding of the doctrine of emptiness or no self. But in this next section of the sutra, the one in which it touches on patience, Subhuti realizes that his cultivation of selflessness has been selfish. In other words, he had been practicing letting go of the self in order to attain something for himself, some rarefied state. So haven't we all been kind of drawn to that? Like, if I do this practice, then I'm going to just achieve, I don't know, I'll be beyond, and I'll have no worries, and I'll just feel great all the time. So it's about me still. It's about me. So now, in this part of the sutra, Subhuti sees that true selflessness is practiced by those who help others put an end to suffering. And then I just have to add, without, of course, the idea that there are others to help and that there's a self who's a helper. So it's like doing this activity without attachment, with just a wild non-attachment. We say, one of the phrases we say in the formal meal chant is, giver, receiver, and gift are all empty of inherent nature, something like that. So really deeply, and yet there is helping that's happening. So it's not like, oh yeah, it's all empty, so just drifting along, still engaging in helping activity. So if we see the world, if we have the wisdom of seeing the world in this profoundly interconnected way as a bodhisattva, and we're all invited, sometimes we say we're baby bodhisattvas, growing into bodhisattvas, seeing the world in this profoundly interconnected way, bodhisattvas don't attach to the perception of a self, a being, a life, or a soul. And then they can practice without attachment, and also practice without being attached to non-attachment, which is another thing they can do. So how is this radical non-attachment possible? The sutra says that we can do it by not giving birth to a thought attached to a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, a dharma, or no dharma. So not giving rise to a thought that's attached to any of these things, sensegates, or even the mind. And to understand how that might be possible, to not give birth to a thought that's attached to these things, we can first look at the way our mind usually works. So it's generating thoughts that are attached, building up a story of anger or a story of the self, a being, a life, or a soul. So usually, like right away, this happens. So like just an example, hearing a sound. I know this was for some of the folks who were doing the outdoor sitting this week in Newell Park. There were some sounds as meditation happened, like of motorcycles, and I don't remember. I wasn't there, so I just heard about it. So anyway, there's the sense organ for sound, the ear. And then this is like Buddhist psychology 101. So the sense organ for sound, the ear, and then the sense object, the sound waves, and then the sense consciousness, which is the contact between the sound waves and the ear. So this happens. There's a sound, like motorcycle, sound of the motorcycle. The sense organ is here, the ear, and the sound waves of the motorcycle, and then it's contact, and then there's this thing. And then right away, the ego consciousness comes in and says, I hear the sound of a motorcycle. So it right away makes I and sound of the motorcycle into separate, independently existing objects. And then we might have some other thoughts that come up, like, my meditation would be a lot calmer if that motorcycle weren't here. So the question, or the invitation in the Diamond Sutra is, can we experience the I and sound of the motorcycle without creating a story of separate independently existing objects? And the answer is yes. And I'm sure you've already at least had once in your life experienced this, and probably many times, maybe didn't notice it right away, or it just came up and then was gone, and right away the ego came in. But maybe just half a moment before the ego consciousness rushes in. And sometimes this happens with pleasant things, and sometimes it happens with unpleasant things. And usually when it happens, and right away, then we have an ego consciousness that comes in and says, oh, that was so cool. You know, like we see a sunset or something beautiful, and like there's a moment of the sense object of the eye and the sense organ of the eye and the sense object of the light and then the contact. And then there's stories, stories, stories. But the stories are there because we had that happen. So I'm pretty sure that everyone has had that. So one thing that can happen with that is it's good. It's great to have that. You can remember that. And you can cultivate living in this way, knowing that there is a possibility of just being without creating separate things. But, you know, then also you can get attached to wanting to just be without creating separate things, and then that becomes suffering. So really it's cultivating a way of being where you can be totally relaxed with what is. So whether that's the moment of the huh, or whether it's the moment of, oh, I see, my mind has glommed on to this, or I see my mind has glommed on to this. Whatever is happening, totally relaxed and being with what is. So not just with sounds, but with anything that arises. And when you cultivate that way of being, then patience naturally flows. You can be patient with what is when you're not separating yourself from what is. And when that patience is flowing, my experience is then my heart is at ease and hopelessness does not manifest. And if we're finding that hopelessness does manifest, does arise, we can still invite ourselves to practice patience as taught by the Buddha in the Diamond Sutra. So here's some ways to do that. One is that we just continue to bring our awareness to the way our consciousness is working. Seeing that contact and seeing the ego come in. We can continue to practice mindfulness. So again and again, bringing our mind consciousness in tune with what's happening in the here and now, or present moment awareness. Or we can ask ourselves over and over, is that so? With regard to what the mind brings up. Or we could say having a very light hold on whatever the mind consciousness brings up, knowing that mind consciousness is almost always under the influence of ego consciousness, that separate sense of I. That really like I that sort of centers ourselves in the whole universe. I am the center of the universe. And, you know, this is kind of how it works, how ego consciousness works. And we're human beings, so we have ego consciousness. So not to get too self-disparaging about it, but to try to bring awareness there. And I'll just use an example from my own life very recently. So yesterday, my husband and I went on a bike ride. It was a very beautiful day yesterday, perfect day for a bike ride. And still, the ego consciousness for me, you know, came up. And, you know, it's like we notice things, so there's not enough ice in the water bottles. It melted, and now they're tepid. We're not going at the speed of biking that I want. Those cars ran a red light. So, like, all of those, it's okay to notice them, but, and even to comment on them, but it's like I was commenting on them in a way that was definitely centering myself. And then it sounds like complaining. And then what happens to the beautiful day of biking with my husband, who I love? So when I noticed that, which unfortunately was like toward the end of the trip, we did have some other nice moments too, so it wasn't all just complaining. But then there was a kind of letting go of that attachment, or sort of noticing that dynamic was super helpful to just like be with what is. And I use an example like that that's kind of benign, you know, and it's quite different from like noticing what's happening in the political sphere right now, for example. You know, you could have lots of feelings about that. However, even with that, it's can I engage with it in a way that's not centering myself, that's not assuming that, or not trying to be right, that's not attaching to a certain outcome, that's just being present, and being present in a way where my motivation is to help free beings from suffering without attaching to that there's an I doing that, and that there's beings who need to be helped, you know, kind of a like a power up down situation. So can I just engage in activity? So that's a way in which we could read the news, we could engage in activism or protests, we could work for change, but doing it without attachment. Not so easy, but that's why we, you know, sort of come together and sit in meditation or do walking meditation and practice. Can I practice just being with myself, with my body, with the motorcycle sound or with whatever is happening, and be have this wide view of no separate things, and have the patience to be present and practice like that? And then I can take that kind of sensibility in the things that are more high stakes. So I think it is possible. And then there's other things that we can lean on to help us, like some of you know the last verse of the Diamond Sutra, and I meant to see if I could get this out because we have little cards of it somewhere, but I don't think they're handy. So I'll say it, and then maybe I'll chant it three times, and you can join in if you know it, and if you don't know it, maybe you'll kind of know it by the third time. So this is the last, it's not the exact last word of the Diamond Sutra, but there's a verse that's toward the very end of the Diamond Sutra. So after all of this talk about, you know, things like how are the specks of dust many? Because what the Buddha says is a speck of dust is no speck, and that's how it can be called a speck of dust. So after all of that, over and over, like those things, like this is here because it's not, and therefore it's here. After all of this kind of mind-blowing logic, there's a really simple answer to how we can be, and that is this last verse, which is, so you should view this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer's cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. And usually we chant it with the Makukyo, so could you do the Makukyo for this? We'll do it three times. I'll just chant the first, the title, and then we'll start. The diamond that cuts through illusion, so you should view this. on a bubble, in a stream, a flash of lightning, in a summer's cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. So you should view this fleeting world, a star. We have time for questions or comments, rebuttals. Yes?
I think that, this is just one of my interpretations. People say a speck of dust is a speck of dust and not a speck of dust. People often think, oh, that's to come to some logical conclusion. But a lot of spiritual traditions have mysticism, and mysticism is like the opposite of a logical conclusion. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's actually more on the sense of actually getting away from logic and having a sort of mystic practice, much like Sufism or, what am I thinking of? My dad's Catholic, I forgot what it's called.
Kabbalah.
Not Kabbalah, that's Jewish. Gnosticism.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, I think.
Yeah, I think so. That's really, it's really a good point. I do think that there's at least two ways to receive these teachings, and that's one of the ways is to say, hey, this is, you can't figure this out logically, just being with it. And that is a beautiful way. And then there's also a way in which there is a sort of, within the tradition, there's a sort of logic that comes in. So I think both are true. Certainly letting go of attachment to it needing to make sense logically is a good Buddhist practice. So thank you. Yes.
I just love the idea, the unfixing of things. This seems to unfix things, because if I say, well, this is that and this is this, then I have to, if I'm really wise, if I say that's ignorance and this is a wise action, if I forget that all wise action is predicated on ignorance, then I end up being in the dialectic of flipping back and forth between being ignorant and aversing it or whatever, or judging it. And instead of saying, this is wisdom, and wisdom is here because there's ignorance, so thank you for being here, ignorance, and let me be your friend.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really true, and I think sometimes people get really tripped up because they think, oh, if I have that view, then I'm going to allow harm to continue because I won't be taking action. But I know you're taking action all the time. So it's like there's a way in which we can be taking action, but sort of having that, really holding lightly the, like, I have a view, like, this is the right thing, but say, you know, and in the end, I don't really know, but I'm still gonna participate in the world and do what I can, but I'm not gonna do it with this tight hold on, this is right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. You know,
I wanted to say something regarding motorcycles. So, I used to practice at Minnesota Zen Center, which is right on the lake, Bede Mikaska in Minneapolis. And during Zazen, there'd be a loud motorcycle, and it's like, get into that story mode of, There's a motorcycle. That motorcycle's really loud. Why don't they get a muffler? And blah, 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 blah. And I'm grumbling about the motorcycle. And the motorcycle actually is long gone. Miles down the road. And the motorcycle and the motorcyclist don't care what you're thinking. And they've been long gone and you're still grumbling.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I think it's okay if we end a little early. We can enjoy the nice summer day, and there's, I think, some treats too. So, thank you, everyone.